Had she had the chance to grow up, she would have become a woman like Anne. Fearless. Strong. She ran a gnarled finger over the delicate petals of the bloom. Trust that your sister will live her life not perfectly, but well. August looked down at the crushed greenery in his hand and uncurled his fingers.
You sound like Miss Haywood.
Another strong woman, though perhaps not as fearless. August tossed the crumpled sprig onto the table.
Miss Haywood is the most fearless woman I know,
he scoffed.
Lady
Tabitha picked up the broken stem and straightened it. Not in matters of the heart, I think. August stared, not knowing what to say. Lady Tabitha tucked the sprig into the vase and approached August, pressing the last purple bloom into his hand. Clara deserves a great love, Your Grace. But that is the single thing she cannot accomplish alone. Dinner was an informal, raucous affair. Someone had taken the liberty of placing a small, petrified creature, caught for eternity in its prison of rock, at each place setting before everyone arrived. This was not a dinner at which polite conversation was limited to the weather, the inconveniences of traffic around Bridge Street, and the latest and most shocking French fashion. Instead, debate raged over the identification of each creature and theories about how and when it had lived. How creatures that didn't exist now had existed then. And of course, there were the inevitable tangents that sprouted when evidence did not match accepted knowledge. Anne had caught August's eye as she put forth her own ideas about the small creature she held in her hand. She grinned at him and then proceeded to draw him into the fray by asking for his opinion. He looked across the table and caught Clara watching. She held his eyes with a soft smile before looking away, as though she understood exactly what he was thinking. For an instant, August wished he could live in that moment forever. He wished he could capture it like the creatures that lay on the table encased in stone, preserve everything just as it was. Because this feeling that was coursing through him, that was twisting all his insides, pressing the very breath from his lungs and making his chest ache, was truly like nothing he'd experienced. And he realized that he was happy, and that it had nothing to do with acquisitions or profits. It just was. He spent the rest of the meal simply listening, watching as Clara encouraged her students to present opinions on a variety of topics, prompting them to fill in gaps in their reasoning with logic and evidence. That kind of clever guidance was something that August might have expected at a medical school or a philosophy class taught at Cambridge. And Clara should be teaching at Cambridge, he thought fiercely. The more he observed, the more he understood that her skills went far beyond mere intelligence and competence. She was a truly gifted teacher, something that very few could say. Any school would be lucky to have her, starting with Haverhall. August looked away, that chronic, leaden guilt bursting his fragile bubble of happiness. He was taking that away from her.
No, he forcibly reminded himself. He had simply bought a property, a very lucrative property that he'd wanted for years. Clara, with all her skill and ability, would easily find another position with another girls' school. She was simply too good at what she did not to. People faced changed circumstances all the time, and they adapted, moved on, thrived. He knew that better than anyone. And perhaps, if she would allow him, August could even help her do just that. A title like his could open a great number of doors, he had discovered. This could be a great opportunity for her, even if she didn't know it yet. Yes, He decided he would quietly do everything he could, even if she refused his help, especially if she refused his help. That decision should have assuaged his guilt. But it didn't. Not entirely. Instead, August was left doubting himself and his motivations and his ambitions in a way he never had before. If he thought he'd felt adrift before, he was well and truly lost now. He didn't return to the Dower House after dinner. Instead, he slipped into the library on the pretense of finding something to read, should anyone ask, but he was met only with a silent room. He discarded his coat, chose a book from the shelves at random, not even looking at the title, and sat in one of the wide leather chairs that flanked the massive hearth. He should go, he knew. But he couldn't bring himself to leave, couldn't bring himself to return to more empty rooms, devoid of the laughter and happiness that had surrounded him here. He wasn't sure how long he had sat, silently in the library, lost in his thoughts. But the house grew dark and quiet around him. The single candle that he'd brought with him into the library had burned down to almost nothing, and now flickered and threatened to extinguish altogether. The Mirror of the Graces, or the English Lady's Costume? A voice beside him said. Are you reading that for research? Or is it a new business venture you're planning? August jerked upright, the book that had been left forgotten on his lap, crashing to the floor.
You could make a man's heart stop doing that,
he accused, his pulse proving that his was still working just fine. Clara retrieved the book from the floor and perched herself on the edge of the chair. It was all August could do not to simply reach for her and draw her into his lap. His heart was still pounding, but for a different reason entirely now.
"What are you doing in here?"
he asked, looking up at her. The tiny pool of light his struggling candle afforded put her features into shadow and made her expression difficult to read. "I saw you come in earlier. The better question is, what are you still doing here?" She responded.
"Waiting for you."
It wasn't something he'd intended to say, but he recognized it for the truth that it was. She paused. "Will you be returning to London with Mr. Down tomorrow?" August hesitated. He should. There was no reason for him to stay. Anne didn't need him here. His report to Rivers was complete. There would be any number of things demanding his attention in London, and being in the city certainly had the added advantage of immediate and direct access to information from the docks. There was no logical justification for lingering here. But then, when it came to Clara Haywood, logic was in short supply.
"Maybe,"
he finally settled on. Clara was silent for a long minute. Then she rose, setting the book aside, and he could hear her soft footfalls as she crossed the room. It was like a physical pain, her departure. He wanted to call her back, but he couldn't seem to make his voice work.
"Clara?"
he finally asked. There was a sound then. The soft snick of a lock sliding into place. He remained frozen, his hands wrapped around the arms of the chair. The candle was suddenly snuffed out with a sigh and a spiral of smoke. He felt her hand on his neck first, the softest of touches as she came around the back of his chair. Her fingers caressed his cheek. "You were quiet at dinner," she said.
"You're extraordinary at dinner,"
he said. "Thank you, though your flattery will not distract me. That's my trick, remember?" He reached up and caught her hand.
"God, I've missed you."
He felt the brush of her hair at his cheek before he felt the soft press of her lips on his skin. And I you.
I wanted to come to you.
Why didn't you?
I don't know.
That, at least, was the truth. He didn't have an answer. Just as he didn't have an answer for why he still hadn't been completely honest with her about Haverhall, other than that she hadn't been honest with him either. Which was no excuse at all. The truth of the matter was that he didn't recognize himself any longer. Every vow he'd made to himself, every driving ambition he'd pursued with a single-minded determination, sat uncomfortably on his skin now. His old self didn't seem to fit quite right. Clara pressed another kiss to the hollow behind his ear.
What's bothering you?
August closed his eyes, letting his head tip back.
I think Anne is in love with my man of business.
It was the coward's way out of that question.
I agree,
Clara murmured, pulling her hand from his and letting her fingers slide through his hair, smoothing it back from his temples in a hypnotic rhythm. And he is very much in love with her. One doesn't need to sit through 3 chess games to see that. She paused. Is he a good man?
The best?
August groaned, and Clara laughed softly. Her fingers were at his cravat and were deftly loosening the knot.
So, what is bothering you, then?
I think I'm in love with you.
It was there, the truth threatening to be freed, but he didn't want to be in love with Clara, because that made everything impossibly complicated and confusing, and went against all the meticulous plans and preparations he'd so carefully put into place for his life.
I don't know why I'm here any more,
he mumbled.
Well, first there was your pursuit of Strathmore Shipping.
Unwanted, unsuccessful, but understandable given what you do, Clara replied. And then there was the requisite crawling around on your hands and knees, spying on your sister. Probably best no one gave her a pistol earlier, she mused. August chuckled, even as self-reproach stabbed at him. Because none of those reasons were the truth. Not really.
Clara, there's something...
But then, Clara whispered, cutting him off, the knot of his cravat unravelling in her hands. There was this. She pulled the linen away from his neck and pressed her mouth to his heated skin, her lips sending bolts of electricity straight through him. He was hard, instantly, his body straining for something he was starting to need the way he needed air, straining for her. He reached back and caught her hand, pulling her around the side of the chair. He didn't care that he wasn't gentle.
I want you,
he said thickly.
Yes,
she whispered. Clara felt it the moment he changed. There had been a strange air of unsettled... something about him this night, something unsure, uncertain, something that was not August Faulkner. But then he took her hand and all of that went away, his intention blindingly clear even in the darkness of the library. Which was good, because her intentions had also been clear from the moment she had left her rooms in search of him. Soon, she would return to London. Soon, whatever this was that existed between them would be over. But for now, she would not think on that. August leaned forward, his hands finding her hips and tugging her toward him. He dragged her onto his lap, shoving her skirts up her legs so that she could straddle him on the wide chair. She lowered herself against him, feeling the hard ridge of his erection bulging through the fall of his trousers.
Clara.
His hips flexed, his hands tightening on her waist. She angled her own hips just slightly, just enough to send scalding pulses of pleasure tearing through her. She rocked against him, unable to help herself. His hand slipped up and caught her face, forcing her head down. He found her mouth with his, stroking his tongue, his teeth scraping her lips. Clara wrapped her arms around his neck, her breasts crushed against his chest. August dropped his mouth from hers, and his tongue played over the column of her neck into the hollow beneath her jaw.
"Undo my trousers," he ordered,
his breath hot against her skin, his teeth pulling at the soft flesh of her earlobe. Clara shuddered. She unwound her arms and pushed herself a little higher on her knees, sliding her hands between them. She worked the buttons, taking her time, letting her fingers caress his cock.
"Witch,"
he hissed. Clara leaned forward and set her lips to the side of his neck. The tendons beneath his skin were corded and straining, and Clara traced them with her tongue.
"You don't know what you do to me,"
he groaned. "I have an idea." The last button slipped free, and she pushed the fabric aside, allowing his erection to surge free. August hissed again as she took him in her palm, running her fingers over the head and down his shaft, cupping his balls. He groaned again, his breathing becoming ragged. Lust raced through her veins at the sound. God, this man aroused her like no other. He made her feel all-powerful and utterly vulnerable all at once. A devastating combination of emotion that left her feeling drunk and dizzy. His hands left her face to slide over her shoulders, finding the edge of her bodice and yanking it down. Her breasts spilled into the cool night air, heavy and tight with need. He covered them almost instantly with his palms and fingers, and every one of his touches sent new spirals of pleasure swirling deep within her. Her inner muscles clenched, and dampness pooled hot and slick between her legs. He took her nipple in his mouth, and Clara whimpered, her hand tightening on his shaft.
"Jesus, Clara!"
His thighs were like rock beneath her.
"I need to be inside you."
"Soon."
"Now."
His hands dropped to her waist, his fingers digging into the flesh at her hips as he urged her down. She allowed herself to sink lower, her hand still stroking the length of him. Very slowly, she guided the head of his cock to her entrance, letting it slide through her wetness. His hips bucked and he made a rough, desperate sound. She closed her eyes and sank down on him, letting him fill and stretch her. Spasms of pleasure already flickering through her at the friction.
"Oh, God, Clara, yes,"
August managed through clenched teeth. She rocked her hips, feeling him slide deep within. A hunger slammed through her, so intense it stole her breath. This was what she wanted. Him. Here, just like this, deep within her, where he was hers. He was hers. His hips thrust up and back. Clara grasped his arms, feeling his biceps flex through the thin fabric of his shirt. Beneath her touch, his body trembled, shaking with restraint. "Don't," she whispered hoarsely, finding his lips with hers in the darkness. "Don't hold back." He caught her lower lip, his teeth tugging as he thrust again, and she rocked her hips in time. His strokes became faster and harder, and Clara bore down on that pressure, feeling the beginnings of her release building within her. "Harder," she begged. He tore his mouth from hers, his head buried in her neck, his body straining as he pumped into her.
"Clara," he gasped, "we have to stop. I can't."
"You can," she said hoarsely. "I want you to come inside me, August." He faltered, though she could feel him still hard and throbbing deep within her.
"Clara!"
"Trust me," she said against his ear, wrapping her arms around his neck again. "Take me." He made a tortured noise and surged up and into her, thrusting with hard, deliberate strokes. She hung on to him, closing her eyes, letting the waves of unrelenting pleasure build. They came, more quickly now, until they crested with a sudden explosion, sending fiery sparks ripping through her as she bore down on a tidal wave of ecstasy. Brilliant spots of white light danced behind her lids, and she might have cried out. August was panting, and she felt his cock pulse within her, and then he drove up into her with a shout, holding her tight against him as he jerked in the throes of his own pleasure. She collapsed against him, her head on his shoulder, her own breath coming in heaving gasps. She made no effort to move, wanting to keep him with her just a moment longer. It was long minutes before she felt him stir under her, his hand coming to stroke her hair where it had tumbled over her back. "You are quite extraordinary. After dinner, too," he said, his voice low against her ear. Her fingers played with the collar of his shirt. "We were extraordinary."
"I can't. You are... This is..."
He stalled. "Yes," she agreed. If she'd had to put the last moment into words, she wouldn't have done any better. If she'd had to put their entire time together into words, she wouldn't have done any better.
"I've never come inside a woman," he said after a moment of silence. "I don't..."
"There is more than one way to be responsible," she said. "If that's what you were worried about." He stilled.
"Yes,"
he said after a beat of hesitation. "A pessary, soaked in an infusion and placed before..." August pulled back to stare at her.
"You came down here to seduce me."
"I did." Clara ran a finger over the shape of his lips. "I hope you are not..."
"Don't you dare ask me if I am shocked, or if I disapprove, or if I found any of this to be unexpected."
"Very well." Clara grinned. "How did I do?" August's head fell back on the chair and he chuckled, the sound rumbling through him.
"You almost killed me. And no, I don't disapprove. I'm hoping you'll try it again."
Clara leaned forward and kissed him, a slow, languid kiss. "I hope so, too." She rested her head on his shoulder, silent for a moment. "Will you stay?" she asked.
"I'd prefer to take this somewhere with a real bed, but if you insist, I won't move. Not sure if I can, anyway."
His hand was stroking her hair again. "No." She listened to the steady thump of his heart beneath her ear. "Will you stay in Dover, for the time left, before we return to London?" August's hand paused, and she felt his fingers slide against her scalp. His other arm wrapped around her back, and he pulled her even more tightly against him.
"Yes,"
he whispered. Chapter 19.
The ships are missing.
As the weeks had passed, Clara had known she had to be prepared for the very real possibility, but that hadn't made it easier to hear. Her brother was sitting in one of the embroidered library chairs, his head in his hands, and utter exhaustion etched into his face. The rays from the setting sun were slanting through the windows and spilling across the fine rugs, their golden colour seemingly mocking in its splendour. Rose got up from where she had been sitting and went to a tall window to run her hand down the edge of the velvet curtain, staring out onto the sun-washed grounds.
"How do you know that?"
Harland reached into his coat and pulled out a crinkled, folded paper. He read it again, as though he hoped to discover something different within, before he tossed it on the small table beside him. It missed and fluttered to the floor, and he made no effort to pick it up.
There are reports from other vessels that have come in of unusually stormy weather. Our ships could be 1,000 miles off course or at the bottom of the Atlantic for all we know. We need to make a decision.
I think we're past that, Rose said quietly. We all knew it might come to this. We need more money and there's no more to be had. We're out of options.
I might be able to...
Harland stopped.
To do what?
Clara prompted. Her brother shook his head.
Never mind. Yes, we're out of options. Save one, of course. Sell a share of Strathmore Shipping.
Clara took a deep breath.
That's not true.
Harland pinched the bridge of his nose with his fingers.
You have a buried treasure stashed somewhere nearby that you didn't tell us about?
His attempt at humour echoed hollowly.
I could ask His Grace for a loan.
Rose turned from the window and Harland's head snapped up.
I beg your pardon,
her brother said into the silence.
I could ask Holloway for a loan.
She held up her hand at Harland's expression. Just a loan. Not a share in the company, but a short-term loan until our ships return.
At what price?
Harland demanded.
What do you mean?
The Duke of Holloway is not known for his charity,
he said darkly.
You might as well sell him the entire company right now. If we offer a share of the company to someone looking for a simple investment, but who is not interested in swallowing the entire business whole, we will still retain control. We will still have the ability to make our own decisions, control our future. If Holloway covers our debt, he will take away that control, maybe not at the beginning, but eventually. The second we lose a load of cargo to bad weather or bad luck, the second we default on a loan payment we've lost. The Duke will annex Strathmore Shipping into his own empire without even blinking. He's made his desire to do so very clear already.
Clara winced.
But maybe he would consider...
If you think he'd be more forgiving based on sentimental reasons, or because he has a soft spot for you because you were his sister's headmistress, think again. Better yet, ask Walter Merrill, who lost the Silver Swan to him.
You make him sound so...
mercenary, Clara said.
Because he is. Because he's had to be,
Harland replied wearily.
If he thought there was even a chance that he could take advantage of our circumstances, he would do so with no hesitation, not because he is cruel, but because he is a shrewd businessman and the interests of his family will always take precedence over the interests of anyone else. No matter what.
Deep down, Clara knew that Harland was right. It didn't mean that she didn't hate it.
Promise me you will not talk of this with Holloway,
Harland said.
Promise me that you will keep him out of this.
I promise,
Clara mumbled. She stared sightlessly at the rows of books towering silently around and above her. The sacrifice of Haver Hall hadn't been enough in the end, and it made her want to scream with frustration and unhappiness.
I should never have sold it, she mumbled.
What?
Harland asked.
I should never have sold Haver Hall, because it was for nothing.
Not nothing.
Harland said fiercely. Without that money, we wouldn't have a ship at sea, let alone two. We would have no chance at all of fixing this. He suddenly reached into his coat and pulled out a second letter.
This was also waiting with the post.
What is it?
Clara asked despondently.
A notice from the solicitor that the new owner of Haver Hall has expressed his willingness to allow the school to operate as per usual for a full year. You will not be required to vacate the premises unless, of course, you wish to.
Clara stared at him.
Why would he do that?
Harland shrugged. Probably because you are already a convenient tenant he can collect a rent from, or because it suits his purposes to have the buildings occupied. Rose had come to stand closer to Harland.
But if that's the case, the fall term's tuition
still won't be enough, Harland told them heavily. A dismal silence fell. We'll fix this, Harland said into the silence. Together. Haywards always find a way.
Clara nodded. Harland was right. No one had died. Her family was still together, safe and healthy. They were not destitute, nor would they be forced onto the streets. They would be able to afford rooms, food to eat, coal to keep them warm. Whom will you ask?
It was Rose's question.
To invest?
Harland looked away. Leave that to me. The Duke of Holloway is not the only wealthy man in London who might be counted on for discretion. I had hoped never to have to do this, but we no longer have a choice.
It had been her hair that had first caught his attention. It whipped behind her in the wind, and the sinking sun set fire into it, sending flames of dark red streaming behind her. August had been on his way home from Dover along the worn road that skirted past the castle when he'd seen Clara trudging up the incline toward the small church that sat in its shadow. He hesitated before he reined his mare toward her, urging the horse into a canter as it surged up the hill. The church grounds were deserted at this time of evening, and August dismounted, leaving his horse grazing in the long light. She hadn't gone into the church, but was standing against the ancient Roman lighthouse that flanked it, staring out in the direction of the sea. She had her arms wrapped around herself, her expression distant and drawn. He knew why. He'd been in Dover to collect his correspondence, including a letter from London that the Strathmore ships still hadn't come in. Harland Haywood had finally been backed into a corner, and August had already shown him the perfect way out. He would approach the Baron again once they were back in London. August's purchase of Strathmore shipping, or at the very least a significant share of it, would get him what he wanted, and also ensure that Clara and her family would be taken care of. He should have felt exceedingly pleased, euphoric even, because this was what he lived for. The culmination of diligence, logic, timing, patience, and a little bit of luck. Yet this victory was strangely hollow. August covered the rest of the distance with feet that felt heavy and sluggish. He came to stand beside her, gazing out in the same direction. Clara didn't look at him, didn't give him any indication that she was even aware of his company. Presently, she pushed herself off the wall and circled the lighthouse, then slipped inside it through a darkened entry. August followed, letting his eyes adjust to the dim light. "Why do you think they built this?" she asked.
"Who?"
"The Romans." She gestured to the walls around her. Why did they spend centuries fighting? Why invest so much blood and effort to build something that, in the end, they simply abandoned? Clara didn't move, but stayed as she was, leaning back against the rough wall, her head tipped up to the clouds far above, visible through the round opening at the top. August looked up at the swirl of scarlet and tangerine clouds reflecting the setting sun against a darkening sky. For a moment, he could almost imagine the light was from the flame that would have burned centuries ago, guiding sailors home safely.
"I would suggest that the men who built this lighthouse had no intention of abandoning it."
He scuffed his boot in the dirt scattered across the floor, scattering a small collection of stubborn, light-starved weeds.
"I suspect that they knew they were building something greater than themselves, something that would survive long after they were gone."
The wind was whistling through the openings,
set above their heads in the circular structure, and it tugged at the hem of Clara's skirts and the curl that was forever escaping. She shoved it back behind her ear. "Do you think greed was Rome's ultimate downfall?" she asked. "If they had stopped sooner in their quest to take over every corner of the world, and had been happy with what they'd already conquered, would they still be here?"
"Perhaps greed is the wrong word. Ambition, maybe. Men will always want more,"
August said, his voice echoing against the circular wall.
"More land, more wealth, more control, more security."
"I think my father would have said the same thing." She sounded bitter. "Both of you would have made good Romans."
"How so?"
"Enough is never enough. You told me that once. My father, I think, believed that too. I just..." She shook her head. "I just hope that ambition ends better for you than it did for the Romans."
"And my father?"
he heard her add silently, because August knew she was speaking of her father's failed ambitions and the mess he'd landed his children in.
"Clara..."
He stopped, unsure what he wanted to say. The guilt was starting to overwhelm his resolve. He couldn't tell her. He couldn't tell her that he had bought the legacy that her mother had left to her, and, after this year, would raise it to the ground. He couldn't tell her that that purchase had been what had led him to pry into her life and then take very deliberate steps to capitalize on her family's misfortune. He couldn't tell her any of that without losing her. Forever. In his old life, such steps had made him clever and pragmatic. Yet, standing here, in an ancient lighthouse with a woman who had illuminated his world, he didn't feel clever and pragmatic. He felt utterly wretched. His moment of triumph had somehow become a moment of failure.
"Tell me what's wrong,"
he said. He couldn't tell her what he had already done. But he could undo this, maybe, without losing her, without risking her ever discovering what he had done.
"I can help."
She shook her head. "No, you can't."
"I can. Is it money that you need?"
The words tumbled from him in a desperate rush.
"Because whatever you need is yours."
Clara had gone completely still, her eyes narrowed. "No," she said after a long minute. "I can't. We can't." August wanted to shake her. He couldn't reveal what he'd known all along without exposing his hand. He needed her to tell him the truth. He needed her to ask him for help. He needed her to trust him. "There's nothing you can do," she said. Frustration skewered all the foreign emotions that were making it hard for him to think straight.
"Horseshit!"
he said loudly, his voice bouncing around him.
"You won't accept my help. Why?"
"Because this is a family matter and doesn't concern you," she said. "And you are not family." That hurt more than it ever should have.
"Then what am I?"
he demanded.
"A friend? A lover? A mere distraction?"
"You were never a mere distraction."
"Yet you keep me at a distance, you won't let me in, just like everyone else."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Why are you still alone?"
he demanded. "Because being alone gives me my freedom, my independence." He took two steps closer to her.
"Independence and freedom don't mean you have to do everything by yourself. They don't mean you have to do everything alone. True freedom and independence allow you to recognize when you need help, and give you the ability to ask for it. Know when to ask for help, Clara."
She looked away. "You're speaking of your father?"
"No, I'm speaking of you. You think I am the only man in the world who sees you and admires you for who you really are?
You think I am the only man who would never take away that freedom and independence you speak of, should he find himself lucky enough to have you? You, Clara Haywood, have become very good at using all the rules of society, the very rules you profess to despise, to keep yourself apart. And I can't figure out why.
She was staring at him, her chest rising and falling rapidly.
You can't figure out why, she said in a strangled voice. Why don't we start with your friends? The ones who dared you to dance with me? What did they call me that night?
They were never my friends, and you know it,
August snapped.
They were the companions of a man who didn't know enough to call himself such, who erroneously thought that he could regain what status his family had lost in society by gaining their approval.
You never answered my question.
Because their words don't bear repeating.
How about if I do it for you? Unnatural? Blue stocking? Queer? Wallflower? She stopped. How am I doing so far? Because even if those weren't the adjectives your friends used that night, I'd heard them all before. Many times.
Clara.
How about Matthias Stilton, then? She said, her voice ragged. A man I had actually believed to be a friend. Someone who had not weighed the value of my dowry against my intellect, but he too reminded me that no one wanted me then, and no one wants me now.
I want you, he snarled.
But not forever, she replied sadly. August could feel his fingernails digging into the flesh of his palms. He'd never considered forever, but now that the word was out there, shimmering just beyond him, it was enough to make him reel. I'm tired of it all, August, she said, and her voice was barely a whisper. Maybe I grew tired of it long ago, if truth be told. It is far easier just to keep myself apart, where there are no motivations to evaluate, no disappointments to endure. I have the freedom to seek my own happiness without depending on anyone else. Experience has taught me I am better served expecting the worst.
That doesn't sound like the woman who once spoke of changing the world.
Clara smiled sadly. I didn't say I would ever stop hoping for the best. August reached out and smoothed her hair back from her face.
Don't ever stop. You deserve to be happy, Clara.
I am happy, she said. With you. August made a muffled noise, and then he wrapped his arms around her and pulled her against him, crushing his mouth to hers. Clara melted into him instantly, wanting to lose herself in him, wanting to lose herself in everything that was this man. She let him kiss her, let him set the pace, let him wipe her mind clean of everything that was not August Faulkner. He swept his tongue across the seam of her lips, and she opened willingly, letting him plunder what had always been his. This kiss, more than any of their kisses, tasted bittersweet, tasted of what-ifs and lost opportunities and desire realized too late. Standing in a ruined lighthouse, the sky blazing above their heads, it tasted of goodbye.
Tell me what I am to you, Clara,
August whispered against her mouth. Everything, she wanted to cry, everything that she had always dreamed of from the very first second he had taken her hand in a reckless waltz. And maybe that was why she had never entertained another man seriously. Maybe, somewhere deep down, she had given her heart away on a dance floor long ago. But she didn't think, for one second, that she was his everything. She knew better than that. There had been no professions of love, no declarations of undying devotion. She had his respect and his admiration, to be sure, but not his heart. She closed her eyes. A friend. A lover. He had never pretended to be anything more.
Yes. Always.
August traced the outline of her lips with his thumb.
And that is not good enough to let me in.
Clara opened her eyes. Not for this. Not if there was ever a hope of their remaining friends, or, even more unlikely, lovers, when they returned to London. Not if she was to keep her promise to Harland and keep the Duke of Holloway out of the Strathmore family's affairs.
I want us to stay friends, she said. So please don't ask me again.
August's hand fell to his side, and for the briefest of moments, he looked utterly bereft.
I need to tell you.
He stopped again, anguished frustration stamped all over his face.
I can't.
The words died on his lips. Clara went up on her toes and pressed her lips to his. Tomorrow I return to London with my students, and I understand that everything will change. But know this, August Faulkner. No matter what happens tomorrow, or a year from now, or another decade from now, I will always treasure the friendship that exists between us. I will always treasure what we were to each other here. Her throat had thickened, and it was all she could do to keep her voice steady. And if you are ever dared to dance with me again, I promise I will always say yes. Chapter 20. Outwardly, Clara's return to London had been peculiarly ordinary. Haverhall continued to operate as it always had, which meant that the routine of Clara's life remained unchanged for the time being. The only difference being that all financial transactions and communications were handled through a solicitor. Harland had secured an investor, though he was tight-lipped about his identity, citing his desire to remain anonymous. It had been enough to clear them from debt and see the remaining ships refitted and crewed. They had also received a letter from Boston, written by the captain of one of their missing ships, stating that both had taken damage on the way there, but that the damage had been minor, the cargo unharmed, and that they would be departing for England within a fortnight. They were expected back before the winter weather set in. The ships were too late to keep Strathmore shipping intact, but Clara knew she should be thankful for small mercies. The last days of summer had faded into fall, and Clara had started the term as she always had, Haverhall full of young London ladies anxious to partake in the usual curriculum. She was determined to enjoy whatever time she had left and make the most of it. She wasn't entirely sure what she would do when the year was over, but the success of this year's summer program was still fresh in her mind. Perhaps Haverhall would simply become a summer program. The class is small, but the students still unique. But despite her determination to stay positive and not wallow, she recognized that she had been different since she returned from Dover. The things that she used to find joy in seemed greyer, as if the color had been leached from them. She wasn't sure if that was because the future was more uncertain, or because she was missing August with an intensity so great it hurt. Missing turning to him to share something. Missing his conversation, his laughter, his touch. Missing everything about him. She had thought she had been prepared to relegate their time together to memory, as she had the waltz they had once shared in their youth. Except it hadn't been that easy. She had visited the museum since her return, and had stood in front of the relief of the Lapeth and Centaur, lost in her memories and her thoughts. Stood for so long, in fact, that one of the attendants had approached her
and asked if she was unwell. She had startled, her cheeks flushing, wondering if perhaps she was. August hadn't called at Haverhall, nor had their paths crossed anywhere in London. Distance was easier, she supposed, in some respects. It would be infinitely harder to have him close and untouchable, and it would make the regrets that continued to linger even harder to ignore. So, when the message from the Holloway residence had arrived, Clara's reaction had been instantaneous and intense, turmoil reigning supreme. The butterflies stormed back, banging against the inside of her ribcage, longing pooled hard and fast deep within her, even as her mind intoned caution and curbed hope. She opened the neatly sealed missive and realized her hands were shaking. She closed her eyes and took a deep breath, feeling foolish. The note was clear and concise, just as she imagined all correspondence from the Duke of Holloway to be. It asked her to attend him at her earliest convenience. There was no hint as to what he wished to see her about, no statements that he missed her, no declarations of affection, no suggestions that anyone could ever misconstrue as anything other than cool and impersonal. But it didn't matter, because the regrets that lingered had told her everything that she needed to know. Those festering regrets had made it clear that she had fallen utterly in love with the Duke of Holloway. She should have told him that in Dover. She shouldn't have said goodbye without telling him how she really felt. She should have told him everything. And now, it would seem, she had the perfect opportunity to rid herself of those regrets. She didn't know what it would bring, but she was done hiding behind excuses. The Holloway residence was a townhouse, located in an older, established neighbourhood, a location still distinguished and elegant, if not new. It would seem the Duke had bypassed the more popular addresses, the wildly expensive squares, where prices reflected nothing except the novelty of the residences. Clara almost caught herself smiling. August Faulkner would pay for realized luxury, but he would not pay for affected vanity. How very like him. The interior of his home was exactly as she had expected as well. The finishings were fine, but practical. The furniture was well made, but not extravagant. The entire place exuded wealth, but not excess. Clara was shown not into a drawing room, but into a cavernous study by a quietly efficient butler. Tall bookshelves lined all the walls except the one that boasted a lit hearth, the fire lending light and a welcome warmth to the room. A heavy, masculine-looking desk sat just to the right of the hearth, its surface covered with papers. The entire room, in fact, had a very masculine feel to it, except, oddly enough, the second desk that sat just to the left. This desk looked new, and it was made of carved rosewood. It was something that, despite its practical, functional construction, looked as if it would be more at home in a lady's morning room. Clara wandered over to it, taking in the neat piles of ledgers, an assortment of what looked like receipts, a small collection of writing tools, and lists in a familiar, feminine handwriting. Anne's desk, then, by all appearances. Clara wondered if it had always been here. Or perhaps August had given Anne back her sense of purpose. Either way, Clara was intrigued. There was no sign of the Duke, or Anne for that matter, and Clara wandered over toward the hearth and August's desk. She knew she should return to the long sofa on which the butler had indicated she should wait. but the emotion and restless energy humming through her made it impossible to sit still. She didn't know what August had summoned her for, didn't know what he wanted from her, but she was trying to remain composed, trying not to hope. She stood near the side of his desk, staring at the glowing coals. A loud crash somewhere outside the study made her jump and whirl, her hip knocking a long, rolled sheaf of papers off the side of the desk. Clara put a hand to her chest, feeling foolish at the nervous tension that had her strung so tight. A maid hurried by the open door in the direction of the disturbance, a broom and pail in her hand, and Clara bent to retrieve the roll of paper from the floor. As she did, her eyes fell on the top corner, a word written in ink that had bled through to the back of the top sheet, easily distinguishable. Haverhall. She stood, the heavy roll still in her hand, and gently placed it back on the desk as if it were a viper. The rolled sheets were huge, the sort that architects and shipbuilders used. Clara poked at them, even as something in her mind was screaming at her to turn around and leave, to turn around and walk away and not look at what was in front of her. Once she saw what was there, it would be impossible to unsee it. But it was already too late. She took a deep breath and flicked the edge with her fingers, and the paper rolled out with a soft thump as it reached the end of his desk. Haverhall was written in small letters along the bottom of the paper, followed by Wilds and Busby, Brighton, July 1819. She understood exactly what she was looking at, even as she understood that it seemed August had solicited the services of architects and planners long before he had ever ridden for Dover. She swallowed with difficulty, her throat suddenly constricted, and a feeling of sick certainty rising in her stomach. She smoothed the wide documents flat with her palm. Across the paper, she saw a drawing of the property that she knew like the back of her hand, the building that housed the school, the old carriage house, and mews, the gardens that spilled out from behind her office, and the pond near the northwest corner where the land dipped and the oaks grew plentiful and tall. The drive that curved graciously in front of the school and straightened toward the road, lined with majestic beeches. Clara pushed the top sheet away, and underneath she found another drawing of Haverhall. Only this one she didn't recognize. Where the school now was, rows of townhouses swept gracefully over the space, forming perfectly ordered squares. The carriage house and mews had also vanished, replaced with a central garden that was beautifully symmetrical and soothing, walking paths surrounding what looked like a fountain. The pond was gone too, more townhouses wrapping around another paved square, a wide avenue marching across the centre. It was a stunning plan, a work of art rich in detail and elegance, and it shattered her heart into a million pieces. Clara didn't need to be an architect or a banker to understand that the development staring at her in stark lines and neat measurements would be worth a king's ransom. Perhaps not now, perhaps not even in 5 years, but soon. The stench of money fairly bled from the very lines of the drawings, and even as gutted as she felt, she could recognize the brilliance of the plan. Developing Haverhall would make August richer than God. There is no amount of money that will ever make my brother feel worthy or safe. She heard Anne's words echo in her mind, though Clara had not truly heard her then. But with the proof staring her in the face, she heard her clearly now. She had wanted so badly to believe in him. He had been forced into honesty about his intentions toward Strathmore Shipping, but given the choice, he hadn't been honest about this. And he had known what Haverhall meant to her. But in the end it hadn't mattered. She hadn't mattered. Not enough. She would never be enough for a man like him.
Clara?
It was his voice from the doorway.